You're listening to littlepodcast.com.
I'm Sean the Orange Course, a retro game fan from the U.S.
And I'm Kevin Vink Tambernino, an import gaming fan who took things one step further and moved to Japan.
Together, we make Famicom Dojo, a podcast that explores the Japanese origins of today's video games and consoles.
And speculates about their future, assuming they have one.
It's modern games with a retro twist.
This is the Famicom Dojo Video Game Podcast.
This week we're joined by Satoshi Matrix and talk about fan service that doesn't include Dead or Alive Extreme Beach Volleyball. We share our favorite fan service-y future retro games, and Vink somehow shares a game that's future retro and Pile of Shame. We also frequently go off on Canadian tangents, so please be sure to check the show notes and our audio bonus there. Yes, we were born to play all this video games. Hey, Vink.
Oh, hey. And hey, Sean, how are you?
Hello? Who's this?
This is Satoshi Matrix. I'm Satoshi Matrix online. My real name's Brady.
I know you.
The Famicom Dojo podcast auditions, right? For new Focos.
Is that auditions.
Right? Yeah. I heard that you want to replace Vink.
Sorry I'm late, Sean. I was busy at the post office. So are we going to get started soon?
Yeah. I think we're good.
Okay, great.
You can just, Brady and I'll take it from here.
Brady. Sorry. Yeah. Time zones. In an hour. And not the group call.
Oh, well, that's...
Wait, you're replacing me?
A few weeks ago, you did mention you were looking for a new co-host who's actually played through Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger.
I didn't mention that.
somebody did.
That was me.
Okay, well, I've also played through Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2 and Mass Effect 3.
Hey,
so...
wait, I don't
you're
like
out, you're out, Vink.
I don't like the way this is going.
Well, we could do it together.
All right. Anyway, welcome to the Famicom Dojo Video Game Podcast, home of the awkward introduction.
Yeah,
as always. And my name is Brady. I am. I go by Satoshi Matrix, and I'm Canadian. Hooray, Canada!
Ooh! Oh my gosh! How exotic today! Look at this.
Yeah.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Satoshi Matrix. For those who don't know, tell us about what you do.
Okay, I'm a retro game fan, much like yourself, and I've been into retro games kind of ever since they were current. Like, I played, you know, games for the NES and Commodore 64, Super Nintendo, and that kind of thing. But I did it when it was new, and I just kind of never stopped playing those kind of games. So I'm a retro gamer, but only by virtue of, you know, sort of never abandoning / stop playing those kind of games.
So you're a hipster. You liked them before they were retro.
Yeah, exactly. I got into the Famicom around 1999 when eBay first started up. And, you know, so I can say, like, I was a Famicom Dojo fan before there was a Famicom Dojo.
Wow.
That's
That's deep. That's deep.
And I've also been a fan of you guys ever since you first started your video series and, of course, your podcast.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I run a YouTube channel where I post all kinds of retro game/Japan stuff. For the last while, I've been doing subtitled vintage Japanese commercials from the 80s.
These are great.
They are wonderful.
Go ahead and buzz market your site. How do the people find you?
Well, people find me. I'm Satoshi Matrix 1 on YouTube.
Okay.
And I'm also on Twitter. Satoshi Matrix is the handle. And I post videos there every day. Wow. So something new constantly.
Oh, God. That's how he does it.
I don't know, Sean. This guy's making us look bad. So we got a topic today, right?
Yes, we do. Fan service.
Oh, no.
In all of its many forms.
Oh, man. It's going to be one of those podcasts.
I can only think of a couple forms it usually takes.
You can sponsor an episode of the Famicom Dojo video game podcast. Just go to littlepodcast.com, find Famicom Dojo, and click the sponsor button. Check out with PayPal or a credit card, and let us know what wonderful thing we should say about you, our lovely sponsor, in this space.
Fan service doesn't necessarily mean sexual content. I mean, that's the idea what people have in their minds that they immediately go to. But it can mean so many different things, especially when it comes to gaming. Like, the first idea that I have is something that is anything that's reoccurring in a series, such as a character or an item or a place, a name, some sort of music,
yeah.
A theme, that kind of thing. Such as you have the Final Fantasy games, where you have chocobos and a guy named Sid. In every single game.
Oh, that's a good example.
Right? How about references to other games in a series? When you have characters that have sort of like costumes or something that you can unlock that references something else. That's very popular in the Tales of series.
Ah, yes, yes.
Or all those, you get all those Nintendo specific costumes in Bayonetta, for instance. I mean, that's what you should say.
Yes, yes. That's fan service in every possible meaning.
Very much true.
See, bring in those worlds together.
Indeed, indeed. Has anybody played the Wii version of Samurai Warriors 3?
I have not. That was a Neo Geo game, right?
No. That's Samurai Showdown. Samurai Warriors 3 is like one of the Sengoku Musou series, but. It's like Dynasty Warriors, you know, it's one of those hack and slash things. And Nintendo got an exclusive on that, which was really weird at the time because the rest had all been PlayStation games. But one of the levels is based on Nazo no Murasamejo, you know, the
Famicom Disk System.
The Famicom Disk System game. And that's a really weird like callback, and most people don't even notice that. But I think that was one example I could think of fan service.
Does it have its music? Because that game has some fantastic music.
I don't know, because I also have not played it.
Especially when music is concerned, is something that really makes me think fan service, because When there's a particular theme or something that gets played from a past game or a character that gets introduced that has a particular musical cue to them. Because music is a really important aspect of gaming, and I'm a big fan of game soundtracks, as I know you are.
Yes.
So, you know, that's something that particularly I would say is fan service-y when there's some sort of overturn or theme.
Ah, yes, I think so. Actually, before we went on the podcast, Sean and I were talking a little bit about this and a particular short piece of music. Sean, you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, you brought up Link's Awakening, and you mentioned, well, I guess I'll let you mention that, but it reminded me that there's actually a couple of references in there, thanks to a man known as Totaku, you may have heard of from
yes,
Cohort Full Bond. So in addition to having his song in there, the Totaku's song, that's in a bunch of Nintendo games he's worked on.
It's like Mario Paint's title screen. That's my go-to example when I think of that song.
Yeah, yeah. What was it if you hit the O?
The English name of the game is called For the Frog, the Bell Tolls, but it's Kaido no Tamini Kaido Naru.
Yes.
That's such a good game. Have either of you played it?
I have played it. I have played it.
There's a fan translation ROM hack. Yep. If you have the ability to play Game Boy ROMs, and it is such a wonderful game, and it's very, very different from Zelda or basically anything else, because your actions are kind of predetermined. You get into battles and you either will win or you will lose based on where you are in the game and what items you have.
Yep.
It's very hard to describe, and I'm probably not doing a very good job, but that's it came out before Link's Awakening, and Link's Awakening uses the same engine as this game for the bell the frog tolls, or for the frog the bell tolls.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to translate. One of those lost classics that should have made it over but never did at the time. But oh my gosh, there's so much fan service in that game.
Yeah, in Link's Awakening, right?
In every possible way. I mean, you've got one of the chomp chains and stuff.
That's right. You
can win a Yoshi doll in one of the games. Kirby's in it. Dr. Wright from Sim City's in there.
The Super Nintendo version of Sim City.
Exactly. The Super Nintendo version of Sim City. From the Super Mario USA. I mean, just...
Wait. Okay, I don't remember Kirby or Wart.
The Kirby was like a random enemy in like the seventh dungeon.
Oh.
It was called Anti-Kirby is what the name of the enemy. Yeah. And it would like try and suck you towards it. And if that happened, then like you'd die. So you have to use the Pegasus boots to dash through him.
And it had the other type of fan service because there was a hippo who was undressing.
Yeah. And that was censored in the North American version.
And wasn't
the Japanese... The Japanese version has like crude boobs.
Wasn't there also some part of a mission where you had to like get a mermaid's top that she had lost as well?
Right. That was again censored in North America. In the North American version, you find a mermaid and you dive down and you pick out one of her scales, and that's what you get as a trading item.
Yep.
In the Japanese version, you take off her bra because Japan.
Oh my gosh! I have a Game Boy Color version of this game. I should just play it.
Yeah.
If you haven't played Link's Awakening,
not in Japanese.
You definitely should. I was going to say if you have the game, well, it's not really. I guess you get like an icon in the menu, but it's just like it says in the text in Japanese, and it's like you got mermaid's bra.
Yeah, they actually call it
like
Buddha. Yeah,
yeah, right, of course.
But oh man, Link's Awakening. I keep going back and forth as to whether Link to the Past or Link's Awakening is my favorite Zelda game. And I don't know. It's been Link. There, it's so many good memories playing that game. I've never played the colorized versions of it. I only played the original.
You definitely should. The Game Boy Color version of the game doesn't really add much except for color, and it also takes away that crazy warping glitch.
Yeah.
Which, again, is like that's a big part of the game and why it's so fun to play the original version. But it also has some little tiny extras, such as there's a cameraman who follows you around. And
Fuzzy Pickles.
Yes, exactly, and he'll that's a reference that Sean will get. Have you played Earthbound? I don't know. Anyway, Earthbound.
Not enough of it. I mean, that was going to be my pile of shame because that's also a good sort of fan service type game. But
Satoshi, we'll talk after the show.
I guess I'm not making a good case of saying on the show.
Yes.
Right, exactly. But there's a cameraman who follows you around, and at specific points during the story, the game will sort of go into this weird cutscene mode where this camera guy, who's like a mouse, will get into various situations where we'll try and take your photo, and like hijinks will happen. The photos that he will take are of like key moments during the game or of key things that you can do, such as I'm sure you know in Link's Awakening that you can steal from the shop.
Right.
Yeah.
If you do that, then you'll come out as guess what you got for free. Do you feel proud of yourself?
Oh, so it's a security camera.
And then the guy will be like, hey, I want to take a photo of you stealing that stuff. And you get it in the album. And the only way to complete the album is to steal something.
Yeah, and then, couldn't you print those pictures out with a Game Boy printer?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was a big thing that back then where like Pokemon and
that was never a big thing.
Well, it was a very, very minor thing that nobody had. Like the Game Boy camera and was a cool item, right? Like Game Freak made that.
Yep. And I like to hook it up to my Super Famicom with the Super Game Boy and use it as a very primitive webcam.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it was like the world's smallest portable digital camera ever at the time or something like that. Like it won some award for that. And there's people who still will like use that. And like there's a device out there for the Game Boy camera that you can hook up through the Game Link cable to an SD card reader and rip photos you take on the Game Boy camera and then put them up on your Instagram account or something.
Oh man, I'm not that hipster. No, can't.
Right. Can't yeah, it. And it's expensive too. It's like it would cost like $100 to do that, to buy this thing. And it's crazy. And there's even an adapter that's sold that will flip the orientation of the Game Boy camera around. So if you have a Game Boy Advance SP, you know where the cartridge slot is on the bottom.
Wow.
Your photos would be upside down, but there's a device to reorient it so it faces upwards. People are crazy with this stuff. So no, yeah, that's another sort of fan service. You know, people who just will take things that they love from their childhood and make crazy elaborate things to enhance them for their adulthood.
Yep. All right. I think that's really great. Let's think of a couple other examples, and we'll keep going into it. Luigi's Mansion.
Absolutely.
The device for like inventory management and stuff was the Game Boy Horror. Do you remember that?
Right. It was a transparent Game Boy Color.
Exactly.
Right? It was the atomic purple one, yep. Right?
And of course, I think the most fan servicey series in existence would have to be, well, maybe other than Neptunia, but would have to be the WarioWare series.
Oh yes, the mini game collections that they do.
Yep, and I mean the games of course themselves are inspired by old, you know, Famicom games and things like that, but also just some of the things the character 8 what is it? His name is 8-bit, I think, and in his room is a Virtual Boy and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
9-volt, that's it.
Right. But speaking of that, like how about crossover games like Marvel vs. Capcom or even Super Smash Brothers?
Oh,
those games are nothing but fan service, because what do fans love to do? They love to pit who would win this character versus this character, right?
Yeah.
And Smash Brothers is totally that's what it is.
Oh yeah, you know? it's just a giant fan service compilation.
Right, and that's why that concept will never go away, and they'll keep adding more and more characters because people want, like, they want the most obscure characters they can think of versus Mario.
Yeah. Sean, bring up some examples of fan service.
Well, I mean, the developers of Lego Dimensions have basically said the whole game is fan service, and I've definitely seen that.
So, yeah.
Definitely. I mean, there's almost not even any point in talking about it specifically because it's just a mashup of everything that you like about everything.
Right, but that's the Lego games in general, right?
Right, yeah.
Like every Lego game is like that. Like, I haven't played too many of the Lego games, but I played one of the Star Wars games that was the original trilogy.
Okay.
Did you play through that one, Sean?
No.
Lego Star Wars? No. My brother did. He was really big into that one.
No, technically, yeah, Dimensions is my first Lego game.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you should play Lego City Stories. The Wii one. The Wii exclusive.
It was the G-rated Grand Theft Auto, right?
Yeah. Grand Theft Lego, yeah.
No, I haven't played that, but I imagine that all the new Lego
City
games...
Lego City Undercover, that's it.
Yes. I would imagine that they all have a similar premise where they will sort of bring something up and then make fun of it.
Yeah.
And that's what the Lego Star Wars, the original trilogy, was, like, through and through. Like, the whole thing of, like, the stormtroopers, you know that scene in that was like, it was a mistake that the stormtrooper hits his head?
Yeah.
You know, in the first movie? Like in Lego Star Wars, there's a big thing like all the stormtroopers are constantly just walking into walls. And, you know, it's just nice. An in-joke that you get like that. And, yeah, so the Lego Star Wars games, or the Lego games in general, a very good source of fan service.
One of the first ones that I could think of that I remember being as a kid going, oh, that's really cool. Did you ever play Star Tropics?
Star Tropics, the first one, yes.
The first one, yeah. Rob's in that.
Yes, yes,
like Rob
yes.
the robot. And at the time, I'm like, that is really, really cool that they did that. And, I mean, that's the whole point of fan service is that, oh, wow, that's really, really cool that they did that.
Right.
Or, I there's the other type of fan service, too. But I guess then people are still like, oh, that's really cool that they did that. But
yeah, yeah. And also the Metal Gear
yes.
robot companion that you have in Snatcher.
Yes.
Is like miniature version of the Metal Gear tank in Metal yeah. Gear. That those two always, I think of similar things because you have that little robot following you around in both games.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, we don't just want to come up with a list of fan service things, but let's get a little bit of discussion here. Mm. Is fan service in games a good thing, or does it alienate new players? And I'm going to talk about both kinds of fan service here because I think they're both relevant to that question.
Okay. My first reaction to that would be it depends on what it is and depends on what series it is. Sometimes fan service can be alienating when they're like, hey, how about this joke? And you have no idea what the joke is.
Yeah.
But it depends on if it's done in a certain context, in a certain way. It really needs to be balanced. It's the same thing as like watching a movie in a franchise where if you're not familiar with it, say like if you go and watch a random Star Trek movie, for instance,
yeah.
like what if you don't know anything about Star Trek, right? Well, people tell you to go watch Star Trek 4, you know, one, yeah. the one with the whales,
yeah.
because you don't need to know any of these characters.
Yeah.
But if you were watching something like, I don't know, Star Trek 6, The Undiscovered Country, like you need to know that, you know, who these characters are, why they hate the Klingons, et cetera, et cetera.
Before I finished before I finished Final Fantasy VII, I watched the movie. What was it? Advent Children?
Advent Children, yeah.
And I was sitting there, and my friends who were watching it, who were fans of the game, were going, did you just see that? And I'm like, yeah, I saw that. And
right,
like,
right.
Can you look at who it is? And I'm like, I don't know who that is, you know. And I thought the movie was terrible. Absolutely.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It was visually interesting, but it was just terrible. But, like, the only time I really was, I think there was some battle that ended, they played, like, the da-da-da-da-da, you know, kind of music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah
whatever.
Right.
And I got that reference. But other than that, I didn't. And I was like, if I didn't know anything about the, you know, the Final Fantasy series, how could I possibly enjoy this movie?
Right,
and
right.
Probably the answer is I couldn't. Would have enjoyed Spirits Dream, whatever, Spirits Within or...
The Spirits Within, that's what I was just going to say. Like, yeah. like the Spirits Within, have you seen that movie?
I have.
Not all the way through.
I saw it in theaters, I think.
Yes, I saw it in theaters. Have you seen it since it was in theaters?
I have not. I remember the Uncanny Valley, though, quite vividly.
Yeah. My man, if you want to find a movie that has aged badly in terms of its visuals, like that movie was all CGI in like 2001.
Yeah.
That game, that the whole movie looks like a PS1 like video. Like it's aged so poorly. But The Spirits Within is a perfect example of why they made the Advent Children the way they did.
Yeah.
Spirits Within was a Final Fantasy movie that had nothing to do with Final Fantasy. It just used the name. So when they were making a Final Fantasy VII movie, they needed to get in the Final Fantasy VII references at every scene.
Yeah, but I mean, it was so heavy-handed that I really think it suffered as a movie. I mean, it was perfect for its audience, and I think that's why I think the constant, maybe not fan service, but the needing to be in the know is why I've had such a hard time getting into comic books because the starting point is just not there. But then, I don't know. It can be done well, though. Look at a comic book movie. They put in a lot of stuff that people who know the comics will get that the people who don't need to know.
Right. That's why I said it's a balancing act where you have to get things, the references that people will appreciate if they're fans, but newcomers will also still be able to follow what's going on without asking a million questions to the person next to them. I think that that there are plenty of examples where it's not done properly. Games that sort of just start you off and they don't explain what's going on in the world, who these people are, why you should care.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot in sequels for things.
Yes.
Going back to Final Fantasy X-2 is a great example of that. It's like,
That's an example of the other fan service, too.
Yeah. It's like these people have now saved the world. It's time for them to be pop idols.
Well, okay. that's what you do.
That's what you do, right?
That's what you do. Oh, my goodness. Okay. I guess the slightly sexy elephant in the room that we've been ignoring for most of this conversation. I guess my second question is, how much underpants is too much underpants?
as much as the ESRB will allow. As long as it doesn't get an AO rating, AOK.
I was going to say, Sarah Z is not sexy.
Yes.
No?
Right. The Sarah Z games are only the Sarah Z as I would say.
That was some Canadian fan service.
Yeah, that was Canadian fan service for maple syrup drinking Brevlin.
Poutine.
Yes.
Sorry, just
milk in bags.
Milk in bags.
Hockey.
Is that code for the other type of fan service?
No, definitely not.
All right.
Oh man.
Canadian fan service. Okay.
Yeah. Celine Dion. Okay.
I didn't understand Final Fantasy Advent Children. Too many Celine Dion references in the Canadian dub.
What were we talking about? I forget now.
Underpants.
Oh, yes. When is it too much, right? I think that it really depends, again, on what you're going for and what audience you're going for.
I guess take a game like Dead or Alive Beach Volleyball, which is fan service the game, that kind of fan service.
Right. Well, I would say, first of all, that game, for Tecmo to deny the third game coming to the West was the stupidest thing they could possibly do. Because the only people who are going to buy that game are the people who know what it is. And the people who know what it is were going to buy the import version of that game. Like, PlayAsia recently reported that is the best-selling game they've ever had, ever. And it's because the game is playable in English. The PS4 is region-free. Retailers not stocking that in North America are literally just shooting themselves in the foot.
Literally, you say?
It's like...
They were so sad that they couldn't do it. They're like, oh, man. Boom!
Yes. And the injury reports at work went sky high, you know? But that's an example where if you're a casual gamer who like sees this, you're going to be seeing like, what the heck is this, right? Unless you know what it is. And if you know what it is, then you're okay with what it is. Or you weren't planning on buying it in the first place.
Yeah. Well, you know? as it turned out, though, I mean, Japanese sales from that game, a lot of people just weren't interested in the first place. But like, I don't know. I'm kind of against video game censorship, but at the same time, like, a lot of people argue now, can you even call it a game? You know, but
I think so, because, you know, it might be sexy, but it's a volleyball game, and if you like volleyball games, then it's fine for that. You know, like I bought the first one for the original Xbox. and it's got like a dating sim element tacked on, and the second game added like jet skis and stuff, but at the core of the game, it's a volleyball game.
Beach, you know? Spikers was better. Hashtag right. Hashtag Beach Spikers.
There was all kinds of things. That was for GameCube, right?
Yeah.
Sega made that.
Sega made it. Yeah.
But volleyball games have existed, you know, forever. I'm sure there are 2,600 games that are volleyball games.
Probably.
Beach volleyball games.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you're into that kind of game, you know, then go for it. But I say, as a fan of Dead or Alive, I like the games.
Yeah.
And I will say that all the fan service aside, the actual fighting mechanics of Dead or Alive, especially Dead or Alive 5, that's a really solid game. And, you know, I am not going to import Dead or Alive Extreme 3 because I don't like sports games. I don't play that kind of thing. I'm taken out of the equation because that's not the kind of game that I want. But for the people who are into that kind of game, you know, it's great.
You see, that's the problem for the type of kind of lonely gamer who wants a very fan servicey game. Do they have to make it about sports? I mean, alienate everyone.
Oh man! But how about games that let you sort of just do whatever you want or create whatever you want? Stuff like Minecraft, for instance, or Mario Maker.
Yeah.
Yeah, that game is insane. Like, I bought that game when it first came out, and I still haven't even unlocked the default 100 skins that there are.
Right?
I have 60 of them or something, but it's like... Yeah. They start to be like, you have to complete 8 random, very hard courses with 100 lives in that mode to unlock them. And I was like, I just can't do this. But
Nintendo would offer us DLC so we didn't have to play the game.
You mean yeah. The amiibos?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I got the Pixel Mario, and that's as far as I'm going.
We're going to move on to the next segment, but if you want to hear more, please check out our show notes at famicomdojo.tv for some more about fan service, especially the Canadian variety. Yes, we were born to fail on this week's target. Looks like on killing a bomb is gone to our target. Thank you for this video game.
Do you like movies? Well, you better, because we're going to talk about your favorite one for 10 minutes.
This isn't a movie. This is a f***ing documentary. This was my high school experience, except I did not get my period. But I'm still hopeful. And if it happens in the next 9 minutes and 52 seconds, I'll tell you.
This is 10 minutes about your favorite movie.
Listen to 10 minutes about your favorite movie every Monday on the Little Podcast Network.
Let's talk about some piles of shame.
All right.
And Future Retro.
Future Retro is a segment where we talk about contemporary video games that have the potential to be remembered as classics.
Or classics that we've played for the first time, or just more recently.
And in Pile of Shame, we talk about the games we haven't been playing, and try to convince each other if we should.
Or not.
All right, so Sean, tell us about what you have been playing or have not in a shameful sort of way.
Sure. Well, I have actually been playing a lot of Lego Ooh. Dimensions lately.
Nice.
So I've been talking about Lego Dimensions on the show before. I think we had two podcasts in a row about it.
At least.
So I want to focus this down to Riveting. Specifically the Doctor Who set.
Okay.
To recap for those who don't know, you get essentially DLC characters and abilities, and if you pay enough money, levels and other related content with all these add-on packs you buy. So the Doctor Who set comes with the 12th Doctor in Peter Capaldi form, a TARDIS, and K-9.
These are physical things that comes with, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the actual set.
Both,
yeah. Right.
So
right,
I bought okay. my own before I bought the game.
It's like a Skylanders thing, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like Skylanders, sure. Not okay. that I've played Skylanders, but I imagine.
Well,
it's
that,
the
I
same.
Mean, like it's like it toys that
toys to life toys
interact with the game. Yes. Thing, right?
Yeah, you stick it on the game on the pad that comes with like the starter kit and the USB okay. pad that plugs into the console, etc.
Okay, I just want to make sure I'm following along.
Yes, and the audience can at home as well. So in this case, though, they're Lego sets, so if you want to assemble them, you have to actually own the game, which is where the instruction manual actually is a soft manual inside the game.
That's kind of crazy.
It is. So
does it actually come with a manual, or is it in the game? Like
there
on the
is
TV?
A manual, but it's only for the figure, which is like... five pieces at, or six at worst. So like the yes. torso, the legs, the head, and the hair are four.
Don't attach legs to head. Okay.
Right. Yeah. It literally tells you how to like attach that, put that figure together. But like the other two pieces that come with it are in the game. And there's kind of a reason for it aside from just trying to be obscure so you buy the game.
Yeah.
Those other figures have three modes that they can be turned into, and that has to do with the in-game currency, as it were, and other items that you can get, and you can unlock those modes, which unlock more abilities. And something I found out recently when trying to play through all the Doctor Who level, because I took advantage of some sales, because $15 for just like two figures with no like extra levels was too much for me. And
you're playing on Wii U, right?
I am playing on Wii U. It doesn't really matter okay. as much, except for this one thing I'll get to in a minute. So I had this Doctor Who set, and I tried to put together the other pieces as best I could based on the pictures in the box. But the TARDIS was really hard because there are things in interior to it that you can't see. It's like, well, where does this go? I literally didn't know how to put it together so that it would be...
You need a lot of Legos because the insides wow. were bigger than the outside.
Exactly.
Wow.
There is like a full-size playset that I would love to get, but I'm sure it's like over $100 and not
wait a full-size TARDIS playset
necessary. Oh yeah, like it was like a fan creation out of I forget what that program is called exactly, where like people can submit things and then they'll pick them up and modify them as needed to.
I would think that a full-size TARDIS would be a little more than $100.
Okay, fair enough.
This podcast is full of fan service,
right? Exactly. So like this in particular is great for like Doctor Who fans, and I think I always have the Doctor in my party just for this reason, because it's just such a joy to have this stuff hanging around. So like the TARDIS is a vehicle, and unlike other vehicles in the game, you can go inside of it, of course. And you pick up like this little like round nubby Lego pieces. That's like the currency in the game.
Yep.
So if you're ever in a bind, because one of the things you can do when you play the game and get to a level is that you have to get so many of those pieces to get like a rule breaker status, and that gives you this gold brick. And I won't explain why you need those, but if you need to go into the TARDIS, you can, and there's always pieces in there for you to pick up. So if you're ever having a little bit of trouble, just jump inside and grab a few of the blue ones, and you'll get to where you need to go in no time.
Can you describe what you're supposed to be doing in this game? Like, what kind of game is it? Is it like a third person?
Oh dear.
Action.
This is
where
it gets long.
You're playing third person, so when like you play things like the portal level, it's kind of weird. The humor is a little off the wall. So like the Doctor Who level in particular. Starts with the Doctor and the TARDIS, and then he's trying to stop this invading Dalek army. And like one of the first things you see when you see the Daleks is they're playing like beach volleyball, and they're knocking over bottles and stuff. It's like and like it's like a first person of like Davros trying to get through them and to like enact his master plan, but they're all goofing off.
Do the Daleks have DLC bikinis?
Do they say exterminate beach volleyball?
Oh dear. Yeah, well, I mean, you have to cover up those Dalek bumps, you know. It's really
Oh my yeah, there's bikinis with like 35 tops.
Did you ever see The Curse of the Fatal Death?
Yes, I did.
All right, they addressed that.
Yes.
So the whole thing is like a tongue-in-cheek tongue-in-cheek in-joke. Like, they do the current Doctor's opening theme, but they have, like, the other 11 incarnations strewn about in Lego form. And I thought that was cool enough, but it gets even cooler because there are ways to unlock all of those iterations.
Is it in-game or is it DLC?
It's in-game. So, like, as long as you have the set...
That's not so good, bad. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not too bad, but you have to go through a little bit of effort. So, like, it's as as, like, if someone brings their Doctor over to your house and you can play with that and unlock it that way. But, you know, if you ever want to play it again, you have to have the figure. Like I was saying, the gameplay is third person. There are enemies on the screen. Like, in this case, there's this whole special Doctor Who level you can go to, which is separate from the one that's in the normal flow of the game story. There's another one there as well, which is also super cool to play. But it was really weird because I had the Doctor in my party already, and he shows up in the game. But because it's Doctor Who, you know, you can just hand wave that off as being like, well, it's different from a different time zone. Anyway.
Does he look exactly the same?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing. That I was in a different iteration at the time. So what happens is you play this game, you have enemies in the screen, and they can kill you, essentially. And then you, like, spit those little pieces everywhere, which you can pick up when you respawn. But when the Doctor respawns, by default, he cycles through his regenerations, all 13 of them.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right?
That is pretty nice.
Now that's fan service.
Right? Yeah. Well, it gets better. So Peter Capaldi recorded actual lines for the game. So, like, the whole dimensional portal thing you use, you're, like, flying through, like, a tunnel, and he will make comments like how he normally uses the TARDIS was the sort of thing. If Doc Brown's in your party, he'll make some comment about time travel. Other similar things. Like, there's just all these little bits in there where they've considered a lot of these combinations that would be clever for them to bring up. So they're really thinking hard about it. But, like, in particular for Doctor Who fans, there are not only 13 Doctors, but 13 TARDIS interiors.
Right. Okay, that's awesome.
Right? So,
and stuff like that is a perfect example of fan service where it won't alienate newcomers. Because if you're a newcomer, you'll just, like, say, okay, whatever. But if you're a fan, that's something that's really going to really be exciting.
And so, like,
it's definitely an example.
The first two Doctors are even, like, you go into the TARDIS and it's black and white and grainy.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Okay, that's awesome.
That makes me want to get this now.
it's so adorable. And then, like the other Doctors, because, you know, they obviously didn't record lines for it, they'll excise a few lines that might be pertinent to the game overall from, like, the different episodes.
Like a soundboard kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
Cool. Sean, cool. Stop making me buy stuff.
Right.
I'd already, after the first podcast where we talked about Lego Dimensions, I had to convince myself not to because of the Back to the Future stuff you were talking about. But now you're going on about the Doctor Who stuff.
There's just so much stuff in it. Like, because this is all, like, apart from the actual level that comes with it, right? This is just the character, which, and you can use the stuff anytime. Like, once you unlock everything, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but suffice to say you have to go into the TARDIS every time you have an iteration that will help unlock it. Sorry, they say there were 13 TARDIS interiors. There's 14.
Okay.
Because the fourth Doctor has an alternate. Because do you remember, like, that crazy kind of wooden retro deco?
That's
in there, and I ran across it by accident.
Yeah. Oh, really?
So I looked it up. It turns out that on the fourth day of the month, and I think every 4 days in the month afterwards, that theme becomes available for the fourth Doctor.
Okay.
So it's a timed exclusive?
Yes, yes. But you can change your system clock and make it happen, apparently.
Oh, my goodness.
Right, so...
Just like Animal Crossing.
Right, I know. But you won't have Mr. Reset to, like, yell at you for doing it. the whole level that comes with the Doctor is some take off the Dalek invasion of Earth, but it's, like, a kind of ridiculous version of the title. And there's a lot of time travel involved, like going back and forth between three or four different time zones, plus some other planets. Even kind of like an homage, deliberately or not, I'm not sure, to the Back to the Future Part 2 and 3 game, there's a part where you have to grow a tree that you need to use in the future. I thought that was really clever.
You mean the NES version?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right?
Fan service.
Fan service. I bought all these other figures at a discount so that I could unlock everything, because otherwise you either have to have the figures yourself or have them from a friend, or you can rent them, quote unquote, for so many of these pieces. I ended up not having one that could cut vines, which is like the Jurassic World guy played by Chris Pratt, whatever that character's name is. That's the only one I didn't have, so I had to rent that guy, but everything else I had at this point. And like, there's the robot from Tom Baker's first episode that comes out. You go back to the past, and there's like a Cyberman that you have to put together, and Missy shows up in the Black Archive. Is it called the Black Archive? I forget what it's called in Doctor Who. Like the whole thing that unit has with all the
Yeah.
And then throughout the game proper, there's also like these paths only the TARDIS can use to go back in time. Like in the Simpsons level, we can go back in time to the Flintstones for some reason, and also go into the future to the Jetsons.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How this the game has? I'm very worried about the future of being able to play this game in the future, because the licensing has got to be nuts.
I know, right? Like there's such a hodgepodge of stuff that it shouldn't make sense in work, but it does.
Oh, and now I have to buy this.
I know.
It's almost as shameful as when you bought AU Senki.
Yeah.
when I convinced you to buy that.
Yeah. Now that's a fan service game.
Yes. That is definitely a something. You know what that thing about that game is that I bought it and I was like, I feel so bad about buying this. I need to convince someone else to buy it.
Oh, that's how this works.
That's how it works. It's you spread the shame around.
And now you feel better about it?
I feel, it's also on my pile of shame. I've played it only slightly more than you have.
To get rid of the shame, I just got to introduce it to someone else. Sean!
It's kind of like The Ring.
The Ring? Oh, yeah. You just got to... Before the 7 days is up, you just got to show it to someone else.
So, long story short, someone say too late.
Too late.
Thank you. It's an awesome set. You should buy this game. All of you should buy this game and just buy the Doctor Who set. And that'll be all you need. It's enough. It's the best Doctor Who game I've ever played.
Am I too late to get on this? Have some sets gone away now?
Sets. I think Wave 4 just started coming out.
I know, but can I still buy Wave 1?
Yeah, I've seen most of the same stuff on the shelves, so you're fine.
Okay, Sean, if you see some stuff on sale, start picking me up Doctor Who Lego Dimension sets, and I'll pick up the base when I go to America.
Yes! So, Brady, what do you have for us?
Now, anyone who follows me on forums or my YouTube channel or anything shouldn't be too shocked at what I'm going to pick, but my choice... For future retro, it's not Pile of Shame, definitely not, is a Hyperdimension Neptunia Rebirth 3 Victory Generation. Or just Hyperdimension Neptunia Rebirth 3.
Sorry, it took so long for you to say the name of that game that we're out of time. So
this game is for the Vita, and it's a remake of Hyperdimension Neptunia Victory, which was the third game in the series for the PlayStation 3. Hyperdimension Neptunia series are basically fan service the RPG.
Yes.
They are MOE, they're turn-based action RPGs, if that kind of makes a sense.
Kind of Tales-y.
Yes. But they're like Tales, except that you take turns rather than... The entirely active battle. Now, the premise of these games is basically to parody gaming in general, as well as anime and nerd culture and basically everything, pop culture. The game takes place in a world called game industry.
Yes.
As one word. It's game industry. And
with an I.
In game industry... game industry is governed by four goddesses. You have Neptune Purpleheart, who is based on the unreleased Sega Neptune, which was going to be a Sega Genesis and 32X combination system. You have Noir Blackheart, who governs Lustation. And she is a reference to the PlayStation 3 and Sony in general. You have Vert Greenheart, who is the goddess of Lean Box, who is a blonde-haired, big-boobed representation of the Xbox 360. And finally, you have Blonde, Whiteheart, who governs Louie. And this is obviously Nintendo.
Yeah.
The four goddesses are constantly fighting each other for dominance of game industry. So it's the whole story of the game is the console wars. Now, the one difference is that Neptune is there. And, you know, Sega doesn't really have hardware that exists anymore for all of the single tears that Sega fans shed. But, you know, in general, it's like if Sega still existed and they made this console, Neptune would be the representation of them. So the four goddesses are constantly fighting each other. And throughout the series, they eventually become friends with each other and then team up to fight a big evil. The heavy in Hyperdimension Neptunia is R4. And her name is a direct reference to the R4 flash cart for the DS.
Oh, my God.
Which was the,
yep,
the flash cart. This piracy is ruining gaming. So let's make the goddesses, the consoles, all team up and fight against piracy.
Awesome.
And that's the premise of this game. Throughout the game series, Neptune and company meet other people that exist in this world as well, and they are all representations of game companies, game developers. Yep. For instance, the first two people that Neptune meets, our names are IF and Compa. And IF is a reference to Idea Factory. And Compa is Compile Heart. And those are the two developers of Hyperdimension Neptunia. As well, there are characters like Neptune has a younger sister. Her name is Nepgear. She's a reference to the Game Gear, right? Right. And there's Uni, who is the UMD drive of the PSP.
Yep.
Ram and Rom are Blonde's younger sisters. They are together the DS, the two double screens. They are twins. And so this is the Hyperdimension Neptunia world. In Rebirth 3, which is the third game in the series, and that's the one that got me introduced into the series when there was a sale on PlayStation Network 2 years ago. Sony had a Golden Week sale for Japanese games. And I saw this game on sale, and I thought I'd give it a try. And I just fell in love with the series. The premise in Hyperdimension Neptunia Rebirth 3/Victory is that Neptune, through some shenanigans, gets transported back in time, and she goes to an alternate dimension that's kind of what the game industry was circa 1989. So in this world that she inhabits, she meets someone else who is in charge of Sega, and there is another goddess of Sega who at this time is a representation of the Sega Mega Drive. And the biggest land in the world is Louie at the time, and you get basically a Famicom version of Blonde, and she, instead of running a little nation, runs an empire.
Yeah.
And at this point, Xbox and PlayStation don't exist. They're not initially there as soon as you enter this world. Now, what's so amazing about this game is that the game references so many things about classic gaming and also classic anime. Like when you start hanging around with Sega at the time, so it's like we're coming up with a new console. What do you think of it? And the people are like, you just keep adding on new things to the existing system. That's not a new system. So there's references to this, you know, the Sega CD and the 32X and, you know, the Game Gear. And there's so much richness and so much humor in Hyperdimension Neptunia. Now, this game in particular is where Compile Heart really started to hit their stride. Because if you might be thinking, like, why would you start playing the third game in a series? Because I know a lot of people will be thinking they want to start with the first one. If you're going to do that, start with the Rebirth 1 as opposed to the original PS3 game, because it's not very good. The series definitely got much, much better as it went on. Sort of like how, you know, Mario 3 is a much more advanced and much better game than Mario 1. But Mario 1 was a good game to begin with, but the point is, you know, it's just a comparison. It's there's so much more they could do by the third time. And because the game throws the title character back in time, you meet the same characters. Eventually, like, Noir Blackheart shows up, but instead of being the PlayStation 3 version, she is like a beta PlayStation 1. So because of this, but she has the same sort of personality, but she's a different person because it's a different dimension, you know? So you get to sort of know who these people are, as the game goes on. So it's a good kind of fan service, like I was saying before. It's a way to introduce introduce players to these characters that they might be already familiar with if they played the other ones, but it doesn't matter if they are or not, because they're introduced for the first time as potentially, you know, the same person, but a new form of them. It's kind of like the Doctor in Doctor Who.
Nice. Tying it together.
So, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, when you're playing this game, it's an RPG. You go from event to event. Now, the game uses a Moe aesthetic to present everything that goes on in the game. Now, I don't know how you guys feel about Moe. It can be really alienating, right? Like, a lot of people will be initially like way turned off from the concept of Moe. Like, when I think of Moe, I think of like cute girls doing cute things, vapid, nothing is interesting, right? You know, like, there's all kinds of anime and games and everything that do that kind of thing. Like, the Idol Master is a big series, yep. And those kind of games appeal to that Moe audience and nobody else. What I think Hyperdimension Neptunia is different is that it uses the Moe aesthetic to get the shoe in the door, but everything after that is all about the writing and the story, because this game is quite legitimately one of the funniest scripts I've ever read for anything. It's fully voice acted in both English and Japanese, so if you are someone who prefers to play games in Japanese or in English, both are there. It's really, really entertaining and how it presents the world and the places that you'll go to. Like everywhere in each of the four nations are references to individual titles. Like, there is like Jet Set Mountain Range in the Sega Land.
Yep.
You know,
And there's like a Halo Mountain in.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Those kind of things they're all over the place. There's like Halo Mountain and, you know, like Jack and Daxter Range or something like that. You know, like, they're all over the place. And so the more that you are familiar with gaming, the more you'll get out of the little in jokes that are constantly coming in into play in this game. But if you are not familiar with the in-jokes, the script is still funny on its base level, that the jokes are fantastic on just on their own. Now, again, they reference things that are more than just classic gaming. If you're into classic anime, for instance, there's all kinds of references to 70s, 80s, 90s anime or film or pop culture. There's Star Wars references. All these different things just add up to make this game incredibly entertaining, and it's something that, you know, I think if you're a non-fan of Hyperdimension Neptunia because you think, like, Moe is scary, you know, not going to be into that, you know, definitely check it out. That said, the game is Moe, and it is kind of fanservice-y heavy in every single way. Yep. Let's just put it that way. Like, I know, Vink, you have played Rebirth 1.
Yes. In fact, I sent you
those games.
Yes, you did.
you can definitely attest to at least some of the fanservice-y bits.
The game is hilarious, especially if you follow anything about the game industry or history of video games. There's Zelda references, there's Mario references, there's just about anything, and some of it I'm like, that is so obscure, I cannot believe they even put that in the game.
Right,
and,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And there's probably a bunch that I'm not catching, actually. I remember you and I spent some time watching some of the ending sequences to try to find game references. In the different videos.
That's a great topic I should mention. In every single Hyperdimension Neptunia ending credit sequence is just a slew of in-jokes and references to Famicom games. And they'll reference some stuff like that's really popular, like Super Mario Brothers and Sonic the Hedgehog, and then they'll reference stuff like Door Door.
Yeah, exactly.
And the stuff that they reference is even the more popular stuff is crazy. Like the Super Mario Brothers 1 reference that they put in Hyperdimension Neptunia's ending is the Minus World glitch.
Yeah.
Of going through the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's a scene that, and it's a little thing that they did it in the credits of each game. And I've put on my YouTube channel, there are references to, I put up reference breakdown videos where I will identify what each reference are for each game. Now, that's an ongoing project. I haven't finished all of the games because there's something like 12 Hyperdimension Neptunia games now.
I helped a little bit
with
music one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, the one of the games that came out here, like, the Hyperdimension Neptunia games are crazy because one of the games in the set that I'm not talking about, but there's another one that's called Producing Perfection, and that is an idle management simulator that got localized, yeah, and you can buy it and you can go to like Best Buy or GameStop and buy an idle management simulator. Like those kind of games never come out of Japan. So, you know, when the game got reviewed, a lot of critics panned it, but if you actually read the reviews, it's because they were confused by even what it was.
Yeah.
Because people think, well, is this coming at some sort of rhythm game or like why are they just singing? Like what's the point of it? Right? Like the point of it is to raise an idol. That's what you do. So these games are just chock full of fan service to a ridiculous degree where they'll reference everything under the sun. And the more references that you are familiar with, the more you'll get out of it. Also, if you're familiar with sort of like anime archetypes, that's something else that's will really help you get into some of the jokes that they'll make. Because the characters themselves are parodies of certain character types, such as the tsundere girl. You know, like the girl who is like really sure of herself, but, you know, secretly is a softy, that kind of thing. There are references and jokes everywhere in the series, and it's something that is totally worth checking out. And these games occasionally will go on sale on PlayStation Network. And like I said, the Rebirth games are remakes of the PlayStation 3 games. So the Vita versions, what makes them different and better is that they add some scenes to sort of pad the game out. There are changes to the battle system that make it sort of better than ever was before. Mm. The older PlayStation 3 games were voice acted at the beginning of the game and sort of in pockets in English. Whereas, so you would go through long stretches in the PlayStation 3 versions of the game that weren't actually voice acted in English. They would just be text. You could turn the Japanese voice acting on and have voice acting throughout. But for the Rebirth games, I guess Idea Factory decided that these games were now popular enough that they were going to warrant spending the money to voice act the entire game all through. So that's another example of what makes them, you know, better than what they were before. But, you know, overall, I think that these games are just really great examples of what you can do if you know your audience and you know the material, and just sort of come up with some crazy jokes. Because by far the best, the biggest reason to play any of the Hyperdimension Neptunia games is in the writing.
All right.
So what you got, Vink?
I have an entry which I will call a shameful retro.
Shame.
That's a new segment, right?
Yeah. It is a game that I'm very much enjoying, but I'm ashamed to have had bought. During one of
is,
these,
is it AU Senki?
No. Well, yeah. I guess this is the first of a series then. But this game's called Monster Mon Piece, and I bought it for the huge amount of $2.
Yes. During a
PSN sale. Yeah. And it is definitely a fan service game in it would be like mythology fan service and stuff like that. But it's a game which relies on, well, advertisement based, the scantily clad ladies who are on these trading cards. It is a card game. It is a collectible card game where you buy card packs and open them. And
but you do that through in-game currency, though.
Through in-game currency, you're not
physically buying cards
not physical cards, but like you can pay actual money if you don't have the time to get the in-game currency. But of course, it made a lot of reception and controversy because of how you can level up cards, which is by touching them and rubbing them.
Are all of the cards female?
Yes.
Yeah, it's one of those games.
But the thing is, and that's why I can't play it around anybody. I mean, and it's unfortunate because the actual game itself is really fun. Like, it's like an actual. I don't know. Maybe it's not super fun, but I like card games. I really like collectible card games. I've played and beat all of the like Magic Duels of the Planeswalkers games or whatever. And I liked like Lost Kingdoms and things like that. I've always really enjoyed those things. I have several types of those games on my iPhone. I've just always kind of liked that aesthetic of building a deck and being able to play and not knowing exactly how a battle's going to go because of the luck of the draw element of it.
I've always
liked that. And frankly, those type of games have kind of gone away. And this one, I don't have a problem with games that have sexy girls in. I don't have a problem with that at all.
Who does? I mean, come on.
I'm sure so. But for this game, I wish that it had the option to turn it off, because I actually do enjoy playing it as a card game, and I'd be able to play it a lot more if I wasn't so terribly, terribly embarrassed to be playing it.
Right, right. So I bought this game as well, but yeah. I played through like the first 5 minutes of like the girls at some academy or something.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, I got other games I need to play, so I'll play this and put it on my pile for later. Yeah. But I haven't like the voice acting is in Japanese. I know that. The text is kind of big.
Yep.
In the text boxes. Yep. But I haven't actually got even to my first card game. So can you tell me like go over basically what the card game is?
Oh man, that's another podcast.
Cool. Can you do it like really briefly, like just like overview. I was like, what kind of game is it? Is it like monster versus monster? Or
oh, you keep summoning monsters kind of like Magic, but they continue moving forward one space each turn. So in a way, it's a little bit like a strategy RPG, just but cards have effects on other cards as well. And if
so it's like a card game version of chess?
Kind of. Have you ever played Magic the Gathering?
Yes, yes.
Okay. I mean, it's not so much like that, but in the same, but that the cards have mana, you know, casting costs, and different colors mean different things. And if different colors are used with different colors, there's different effects. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm enjoying it, but I'm looking, I'd love a recommendation if one of our listeners or one of you guys has one. I would like to, because I'm almost finished with this game. I'm on the last part of it. I've almost unlocked all the achievements as well.
Ah, congratulations.
Thank you. Because it is a game where you can play a round of it and then turn it off.
Right, right.
And that's and each round is about 5 minutes. So it's the perfect type of game to play with my schedule. Mm.
And the Vita being portable.
Yeah. When it's done, I want another one, and hopefully one that I can play in public. So I've never played a Yu-Gi-Oh! Game. Should I?
I have. Yu-Gi-Oh! Games are complicated, and they don't do a very good job on explaining the rules.
Mm.
And they also give you, like, the worst starting decks possible. And because they like the Yu-Gi-Oh is based on like stronger monsters have stronger numbers attached to them.
Yeah.
Right. And you have a number of points, and the point of the game is to deplete the points from your opponent. So if you have like a really strong monster and a set of strong monsters, a card game in a Yu-Gi-Oh match will be over in a couple minutes. But when you first are starting the game, you have incredibly weak monsters, and so do all of your opponents to make the game, you know, at least fair for you to start with. So when you start playing a Yu-Gi-Oh video game, one of those things, I have one for the Xbox, the original Xbox, and no joke, some of those card games can take about 2 hours to complete a single battle.
Well, I'm out.
instead of that, I would recommend there were the Pokemon trading card games that came out for the Game Boy Color back in the day. And the first one came out in English.
Yeah.
And it's if you've never played it, it's actually a surprisingly decent game. Like I'm not the biggest Pokemon fan. But it's like there was a Punnel de Pon game that came out for the N64.
Yeah.
And that game didn't require you to know or care about Pokemon whatsoever. And it's kind of the same deal with the Pokemon trading card game. Hudson made it.
Okay.
And as opposed to Game Freak or somebody else, you know, and actually knew what they were doing with Pokemon. They were like, let's take this concept and let's apply it to the Game Boy and kind of see what they could do to make it so it'd be approachable for the non-Pokemon fan. And if you are a Pokemon fan, you'll like, oh, hey, I know these cards. You know, I used to collect them or whatever, you know. But that game has just the best tutorial in any game I can think of. It's something that, and I'm sure you could find it for very, very cheap, the Game Boy Color Pokemon trading card game.
I'll look into it. I mean, it sounds like a little bit like Card Fighters Clash that I used to play
Neo
Geo Pocket. Yeah.
Card Fighters Clash for the Neo Geo was very similar to Pokemon card game. And I remember reading gaming magazines at the time when they were like, if you like Pokemon trading card game, buy this for your Neo Geo Pocket, you know. That kind of thing.
They should have said buy the Neo Geo Pocket so SNK had to go out of business.
Yeah. Oh man, that's another sad story. Like I used to love the Neo Geo Pocket, and I still do. I wish SNK or Playmore or something would make a new system that wasn't the Neo Geo X.
Yeah.
I mean, like I that system is so beautiful. The way that it's got that little click stick.
Yep.
Ah, love it.
Anyway, I think we've run to the other side of this whole time thing. If only we had the TARDIS here so we could have found a way to compress that time. But
get more Lego bricks.
Indeed. We need more Lego bricks. So, Sean, you got anything to add?
I did want to mention one more thing about Lego Dimensions, specifically the Wii U version. Because I promised I would. I didn't get back to it. I play this game a lot due to my four-year-old who's super into the idea of Legos. He can't really put them together himself right now, but the new sets have been getting like I'll wait until he's with me and he'll help me like search for pieces, and I have to put because they're really little tiny sets, so there's a lot of little pieces on them. But actually playing the game itself, the Wii U has the advantage of the gamepad. So one of us can use like a pro controller and go off on the screen, and then he can use the gamepad or vice versa and control our own characters that way. And I don't know how that works.
Well, you can play together then.
Yeah, we can play together, but but not have to be in the same physical locality, which in the main game isn't much of a big deal because you tend to like have kind of a fixed area that you're in. But like if you're in there are these big open world sections,
sandbox,
and you can like do missions and stuff, get more gold bricks and whatnot that way. You know, there's one for Doctor Who, so there's another Doctor Who level on top of the one that you got with the game.
Nice.
And so you're able to like run around these levels, and he's, you know, he's only four, so he's most interested in just like riding around the vehicles, just like exploring and not really, you know, playing the game as such. And that's fine. And like, you even have your own, like Lego brick count, as a result of that. So he can do whatever he needs to do, and I can like run missions, and we can play together without playing together, you know? And like, once he's old enough to actually get the objective of the game, we can still like coordinate. But like right now, as young as he is, it works really, really well. And he's super interested in doing it whenever he can. So it's getting me to play, which I wouldn't do otherwise.
Right.
I know how that happens. That's how I'm beating a lot of games lately, is the kids give me motivation because they want to watch it like a show.
Right. I mean, who else has like live home entertainment Let's Plays, like, right? So.
My goodness, my daughter the other day, she's just using the Wii U and she's going around YouTube, and I'm like, what is she watching? She's like watching videos of kids playing with toys. And I'm like, you know, you could have toys.
But I don't have these toys, Dad.
Yeah, exactly. Man. And I'm just like, what is it's kind of like a commercial. And I was like, who would watch this stuff? And I'm like, this video has 20 million hits. It's kids playing with toys. And I'm like, oh man, it's
we're doing it all wrong. Like,
it's like Let's Plays toys, and I just
Just as one final thought, what are your thoughts on fan service in like a statement, each of you? Is it good or is it bad? Do you prefer games that have it? What do you think?
I like it if it's something that I like, and I don't like it if it's things other people like that I don't like.
I'm so embroiled in it. I think I need it to a certain extent to enjoy some things. And I like being inundated with references I get. On the other hand, I realize that's not a sustainable model and will enjoy new things once in a while. Like, I stopped watching exclusively superhero TV shows because Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was recommended to me. I almost said Super Ex-Girlfriend, which is a totally different film, but so it's good to get out of your shell once in a while. But I, you know, the milder forms that we talked about, I think are fine. As for the others, I think it speaks to a cultural divide happening between Japan and the U.S. right now. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. As for me, I think that fan service at this point in my life, tends to be mostly what I play, because I'm not just talking about, you know, the sexual kind of thing, like that kind of anything like to do with that. I mean, because fan service encompasses so much, it brings back memories of playing something else when you get a reference to like a character, or when there's, you know, when I'm playing, you know, a video game like Smash Brothers or something, it's like, hey, I remember playing Ice Climber on NES. I want to play that now. You know, that kind of thing. So for me, it's kind of a mixture between nostalgia and just enjoying something new at the same time versus something new. When you walk into and play something new, you don't know if you're necessarily going to like it or not. You try and base your purchase decisions on what you already like, right? But like, I'm sure you guys have played some indie games that are totally brand new concepts, and you kind of just take a chance on it because you don't know if it'll be something that's good or not.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like for me, I'm a big fan of Shovel Knight, going back to that again. And Shovel Knight exists as fan service to all sorts of things that have been established before. In fact, it's a fan service to video game design.
Yeah, I'd say that's
think about
fair.
It like platformers, it's a reference to DuckTales, Mega Man, you know, Mario, all these things cobbled together.
If I may plug an earlier episode of the podcast, we did talk about the article written about it, where they tried as much as they could to emulate an actual NES, you know, minus
right, exactly.
some like video effects and whatnot, and where they had to break the rules by like adding a couple colors that the NES couldn't do. They would.
Right. Right. The premise of that game was to be like, the last mapper for the NES was the MMC5, the most advanced one, and that was made in 1990. So like, what would happen if they continued to make mappers for the NES for the last, you know, 25 years? And this is what you might get.
Right.
I mean, that game uses the VRC6 sound. That's actually the soundtrack. You can get that as an NSF and get and play that on an NES Power Pack.
You know, I was wondering, because you know it's all like, you know, compiled sound in the actual game. But if they wanted to, and we were talking about this with the Retro VGS before it became
so sad
something else. Like you could save some space by just programming it that way through the
right
virtual hardware. To train your game, head over to our show notes at famicomdojo.tv/podcast for additional pictures, video, and bonus audio for this episode. Call us at 608-492-1923 to leave a voicemail for our Denchi Mail episodes, or send us a comment on Facebook or Twitter at Famicom Dojo. Consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes, and be sure to subscribe to Famicom Dojo on YouTube for our latest videos about retro, import gaming, and more. Well, dear listeners, thank you for joining us in this awesome adventure. Thank you to Brady for leading us through it. I'm sure Vink will get back to you about your application soon.
Oh, thanks you. Hopefully it won't get lost in the mail from Japan.
No promises.
All right. So I guess then until next time, the dojo is...
full of fan service. I didn't want to bring this up until now, but during this entire time, I've been wearing the DLC Phoenix Wright costume. This entire episode.
It's better than your Mewtwo costume.
That's impressive.
People were getting upset with me that I was totally nude, so I added a croissant bracelet. croissant necklace. Actually, for anybody who does follow me on MeTomo, and that means you, Daves.
These are the Daves I know.
Which one?
These are the Daves I know. if I haven't added you, I right now have about 70 requests coming in. Please tell me who you are so I can add you, because if your name's like cool guy, I'm like, I know tons of cool guys. Who is this?
I'm a cool guy.
Yeah. So please let me know, because I've added several people who I thought were different people and made reference to something that we did to have them be completely confused, because they're a person I don't know. I thought I was adding a game Dave, but I added a Dave I don't really know so well.
These are the days I don't know. These are the days I don't really know.
Famicom Dojo.
The Famicom Dojo Video Game Podcast is produced every week by That's Orange LLC. Our theme songs, Famicom Thrash and RPG, were written and performed by the Amari Tones. Find them on iTunes and at amaritones.net. Pixel art by Lewis Lloyd Judson at lewistrations.co.uk. Find us at famicomdojo.tv/podcast, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or wherever RSS feeds are downloaded. And, of course, head over to littlepodcast.com to listen to other great shows on the Little Podcast Network.